Welcome to Just Now Possible with Teresa Torres.
My name is Tom Vanadouf. I'm a principal product designer at eSpark. I've been with eSpark for about over 10 years. Currently, I'm working on early discovery, which you might appreciate, on the early reading intervention. We're not familiar with that space. It's about dyslexia, speech and language therapy. This is new for us, but we're doing some early discovery there. And at the same time, we're closely eyeing something that we launched briefly, eSpark Teacher Assistant. So we're looking at that really closely and see what we can learn there.
My name is Mary. I am the Director of Learning Design and a Product Manager at eSpark. Tomorrow is actually my 13th year at eSpark, wow. Which is wild. Yeah, and I joined eSpark. I was a former teacher. Education is close to my heart. It's what brought me to eSpark. And as Tom mentioned, right now, what I'm currently working on is this monitoring and continued delivery of this most recent teacher assistant that we're excited to talk more about with y'all today.
Excellent. I'm Ray Lyons, the VP of Product and Engineering at eSpark. We've all joined around a similar time, so I'm coming up on almost 12 years at eSpark as well. Before eSpark, my background is in management consulting, and so to bring that to my sort of product management toolkit. At eSpark now, I'm leading product strategy, product vision, working with the executive team and the board to make sure that they're excited about what we're shipping and the problems that we're solving. The last almost 3 years now, we've been on this sort of LLM-driven journey of what's now possible with LLMs and how can we reimagine learning for students and teachers with the power of LLMs. And we've come a long way since the dawn of ChatGPT in November of 22. And we've shipped, this will be the, we're currently shipping now our fourth sort of LLM-based or AI-based major feature. And excited to talk to you about that today.
Excellent. For listeners, can one of you just give maybe the high-level overview of what eSpark does?
All right. At a high level, eSpark is an adaptive reading and math program where the most common use case is where students in kindergarten through fifth grade will take a short diagnostic test, and then basically eSpark sets them on an individualized learning path that they work on. And they can work on this from kindergarten up to fifth grade. Basically, one of the problems it solves is that in a typical third grade classroom, kids work at very different levels, right? You have a third grade classroom, some kids are reading at a fifth grade level, some kids are reading at a first grade level. This adaptive path basically takes all of that into account and adjusts instruction based on that. And then the second half of what eSpark has is this thing called assignments. They're basically pre-made lessons. They're really short. They consist of a video, a game, an assessment. That's it. It basically follows a basic pedagogical model of I do, we do, you do. And it works really well. And I think those are the most common use cases. And I think for in the classroom, when you go into a classroom where eSpark is being used, is during the small group time when the teacher is sitting in a corner with six students and the rest of the students work independently, either at different tables and they rotate. And eSpark will be part of one of those groups.
I love this for a few reasons. First of all, third grade was like my banner year in elementary school because I finally had a teacher who let me run at my pace. So this idea of letting kids go at their pace is amazing. Shout out to Mrs. Price. I actually don't know her first name because I was a third grader. But yeah, amazing. And it was reading and math that I literally just wanted to run ahead and actually was allowed to. That's amazing. I want to touch on, Tom, something you said that if this is going to be relevant to our conversation, you said, I do, we do, you do, which I love this model in teaching. Do you want to just give a little bit of context what that means?
Yeah, I'm echoing Mary's expertise here. So I'm going to let Mary take this one. This is like deep.
So it's the gradual release of responsibility. And really, it's the model where within a classroom, the I do would be the teacher standing in front of the class and they're teaching a new skill and they are going to show students model exactly how to do that skill. And so there, it's think of more of the direct instruction of showing them exactly how to do it. Then they're going to move into we do, where it's going to be a joint effort together. So it's going to be maybe some questioning and answering, having students fill in and do that with them. And so within eSpark, if we're thinking of the I do, we do. The I do is an instructional video that we give to students. The we do is where they're going to be getting a game or some sort of a practice opportunity. And so they're answering questions, they're getting immediate feedback, getting hints, scaffolds along the way to complete it. And then the you do is where they're going to be doing something completely independent without lots of hints or cueing or anything like that. And in eSpark, that's where they're going to be doing their assessment, where we're no longer going to be giving them the instruction or the hints along the way. So that's the general model that we follow.
I love this. I feel like already just by talking about what eSpark does, we've settled on what I think are probably two of the most common pain points for K through five teachers. I've got kids all moving at different paces and I need lots of content. All right, let's talk about, I know we're going to dive deep on one of the AI features you recently built. It sounds like it's Teacher Assistant. Do you want to give some, does one of you want to give some context for what that feature is, how it came about?
Maybe I'll talk about it just in the context of the different stakeholders we look at. We talked about the product problem and we focus a lot on the sort of the teacher problem, but our mental model of this of the EdTech landscape is we call it the chain link of three stakeholders. It's students, teachers, and administrators. And students are obviously actively using the product every day, but are not purchasing the product and also don't really have say over whether or not they get to use the product. Teachers sit in the middle where they're really the sort of gatekeeper of, you know, are we going to go on eSpark today and for how long? But in our model, teachers are not paying for it either. And at the top of the chain link, it's the administrators or the buyers. And those are the folks that assistant superintendents, directors of curriculum in the US. And they pay for it, but they're not really active users. They have data dashboards that they seldomly use. And really, so part of the product strategy for us is how do we provide value to all three of those stakeholders while also holding sacred, trying to keep it fun for kids and trying to make it easy for teachers. With that as the context, we were doing, we were doing some continuous discovery. I'm talking to administrators on a regular basis and talking to teachers on a regular basis. And the sort of origin of this teacher assistant that we'll talk about was threading together two of those stakeholders, essentially threading together an insight from administrator interviews and an insight from teacher interviews. And the context here is when COVID happened and all learning went digital, there was this explosion of what we call digital supplemental learning programs, which eSpark is one of, and school districts went hog wild on buying every supplemental product under the sun, right? So they went from having a couple supplemental digital programs to having 50. And as you can imagine, in the sort of post-COVID years, there's been a bit of a reconciliation of those supplemental programs, and there's been a pull away from letting teachers pick their programs and having this long tail of supplemental to more top-down control and administrators wanting to wrestle back control. And that's coming in the form of administrators wanting to have more control over what we call the core curriculum, or essentially the main textbooks of reading and math. So during our administrator interviews, one of the common threads that we were hearing was the importance of core curriculum and the relative, the sort of us, the supplemental folks being relegated to a bit of a sideshow. And that was pretty dangerous for us to hear, right? Because we used to be the star of the show. And now there's this big core curriculum sort of cloud looming. And we were feeling like it was difficult to tell a coherent story about why eSpark is valuable vis-a-vis your big core curriculum investment. So that was something that was in the back of our minds as we were talking to administrators. And at the same time, talking to teachers on a regular weekly basis, so we could talk about our teacher interview cadence at some point if you want. But teachers were feeling the pressure from their administrators of, oh my gosh, they're telling me to use this core curriculum. I only got one day of training on it. The user manual is 1,000 pages long. I'm totally overwhelmed. Not only does it have not enough resources for the kids, it also has too much resources for the sort of instructions. So it's this very difficult challenge that teachers have of trying to fulfill the mission of helping their students get on grade level for math and reading content, but also following the sort of district mandates of this core curriculum. And the question they would ask is, can eSpark help with this? So tying together the insight of administrators want this core curriculum followed by the T, by teachers. And here we have all this amazing eSpark content, but it's on an island away from the core curriculum. We thought we had an insight of, could eSpark help teachers with their fulfill their core curriculum? And because we were on this sort of strategy of building LLM-based features that, you know, are able to do things that weren't previously possible or just not possible, we had this insight of, could we use an LLM to essentially understand all of what eSpark has to offer, understand all of what the core curriculum needs, and then just marry them to essentially a fancy recommendation engine, but a recommendation engine in a way where teachers can talk with it and we could do things beyond just, I would say, like a more deterministic recommendation engine.
Okay, I heard a lot of things in there I liked, but I want to ask some clarifying questions.
Sure.
So if we're looking at a school district, I'm assuming the school district has a core curriculum.
Yes.
And that's not common across all schools. Like each school district is creating their core curriculum. Is that correct?
I would say 20% sort of home grow it, 80% buy one off the shelf. But you are correct in there is a plethora of these publishers. There's hundreds of these publishers.
Okay. So there's content providers that they can buy a core curriculum from. Yeah. They can create their own core curriculum. But a good way to think about this is a school district has a core curriculum.
Yes.
And the big insight from talking to administrators was their primary focus is on that core curriculum. And they viewed eSpark as outside of that, as supplementary to that.
Yes.
And so you wanted to look at how do we help schools use eSpark in the context of their core curriculum.
Yes, because the administrator's main goal was, I just spent $5 million on this core curriculum. I got to make sure it's successful.
Yeah.
And if they're giving teachers other things to do, the mind share for the admin was all of the core curricula. And we wanted to find a thread to have eSpark be part of that thought process and not in a side, not a sidecar.
Teresa, just to illustrate that with an eSpark, with a classroom that is doing eSpark, a third grade teacher is teaching third grade skills and the core curriculum prescribes third grade skills.
Yeah.
When the teacher looks at what kids in eSpark are working on their adaptive path, most likely that's not third grade skills. So they're working independently, they're making progress, they're filling gaps, they're doing great. But for an administrator, it's kind of, wait, this is our core curriculum, this is what we're supposed to be working on. So there was a little bit of pushback on that as well, where they want teachers to use eSpark more with more intentionality. That's the word that kept popping up in these interviews. We want them to not turn it on and have them run with it. They want teachers to assign something, look in the data, make instructional decisions. So more teacher engagement in general was like another thing we heard from administrators.
Okay. So I'm like having a conflict in my head about what I think leads to good teaching versus what you're hearing from, but I'm going to set that aside.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you identified this really clear need around, we like your product. We need it to be not supplementary, but maybe they weren't even saying that. You saw this as, in order for us to survive, we need to plug closer into the core curriculum.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And then because the core curriculum can be different at different school districts, it's not as simple as we'll look at your core curriculum and create some content around that. It's more like we need to look at all the content we have and make sure the teacher is using the content, can easily use the content that supports their core curriculum.
Yeah. And I think if this was in the pre-LLM era, we wouldn't have had the audacity to think that this was possible our team was quite small. But the idea that, like, you wouldn't be able to, like, human manually do this in any sort of a sustainable way, because you have hundreds. So for each grade level, there is just lots and lots of detail across math and reading. And then you also have to support the use case where a district custom creates their own scope and sequence, their own core curriculum. We did it ourselves. Part of the vision here was, what is a sustainable way to do this so that we can ingest essentially any core curricula and just have it work instantaneously? And that's where we got really excited about the technology side, because without LLM, we didn't think that would be possible.
Okay, so it seems like in a pre-LLM world, like you might have had to go like one curriculum provider at a time.
Yeah.
Let's see if we can put together a packet of stuff for that curriculum provider.
Right.
Sounds like there's lots of curriculum providers that would not have scaled very well.
Right.
And so now looking at what's just now possible, we can say, okay, maybe LLMs can help us with this matching.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Is this a need that had arisen previously? Like, I know at every company, there's always these like needs where we're like, we know we should do that, but we can't, it's hard and we're never going to get there. Or was this kind of just a timing post-COVID kind of thing where the timing just aligned with LLMs?
It's a good question.
I think it started popping up post-COVID, when I think we saw less organic traffic and less organic usage, right? Would you agree? Because it, I think this was a new problem that sort of presented itself, like post-COVID, and what we were hearing from administrators.
One thing that we wanted to do was, we had been, for the previous 2 years, we had been building a bunch of AI power features for students. We know we wanted to build something for teachers, but it had been a minute since we built something for teachers. And we wanted to do something that made eSpark just much easier, much faster, higher value to our teacher users. So we were itching to do something for teachers. We didn't exactly have a clear sort of target opportunity until this insight of sort of administrator need and teacher pressure. And so it wasn't like we felt like we had to zag and do something outside of our main comfort zone. This was very much in the sort of core product strategy of make it very easy for teachers to use and give teachers delight. Like, one of the nice things about the way this works is teachers are, whether they like it or not, they live in these core curricula. They have these binders and books and they're everywhere. So when they come into eSpark and they can say, this Eureka Math is my math curriculum, they feel very much right at home because they know the lessons there. So it brings us, I think, a little closer to them. And that's something that is very much on strategy for us.
And one other thing that I would add, and I don't know that we like have the hard evidence for this, but I think it came up a lot in our teacher interviews too, is in the last 5 years, there's been shifts in what is the best practices for teaching reading. There's been a real shift to what everyone's calling the science of reading right now. So all of a sudden we're shifting away from one way of teaching reading that people have been teaching reading for the last 15 years into a new way of teaching. So we were also encountering teachers who were getting brand new core curriculum that they'd been teaching with something for the last 10 years. And now they're getting something completely brand new. All the resources that they'd had and been using go out the door for what they'd been using. So I think there was also this need for teachers to feel like they had better access and support to the new core curriculum that they'd be using.
Yeah. Okay. So clear problem. I love this.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about, if you could, first of all, how long ago was this?
The beginning of the teachers, thinking about teachers, I think it was April 24. That was the first, remember I wrote this like document and Mary and I, you started talking about it, this idea of this like super agentic teacher assistant. We were super excited about all this new LLM stuff and we started riffing on it and we came up with what if all this stuff. And I think that was the first idea. And then it set for a while because we were busy like still building all this stuff, this student facing stuff.
But I think that was the first. And this was your first AI feature. So you had already had a little bit of experience with building LLM products.
Yeah, we had a lot of pain and suffering of trying to home roll a bunch of AI features. And I think when we'll get to evals later, but when we found evals.
Life-changing.
Yeah, evals are life-changing. Okay, so give me just a snapshot of kind of April 2024. What was in your toolbox for building AI products and features? What was your experience level at that point?
Yeah, I would say like basically we were relegated to the OpenAI playground environment, and which at that time didn't even have things like version prompts.
Yep.
So we had all sorts of Mary and her team. So Mary's not only product manager, but she also leads our team of learning designers who are the curriculum experts. And a lot of the times when you get into sort of the weeds with these prompts, you need a pedagogical expert to get in there. So there's multiple people going back and forth with prompts, and they had built these crazy complicated Notion spaces to track prompt versioning, to track changes, comments, all that sort of stuff. So we were basically in OpenAI Playground with a bunch of Notion docs and then just home roll, just using the OpenAI APIs, the completions API endpoint to just single shot that just one prompt call at a time. So pretty basic.
I just want to say some of this was pretty high stress because this was student facing stuff, right? So it had to be, you can't just have an LLM spit out something and put it in front and then have a teacher see it. And it's like, it was pretty important that we got this right, that we got the leveling right. And Mary can talk more about it, but we were basically we didn't have any tools to evaluate this like properly. And it was highly critical that we didn't make any big mistakes, because it only takes two or three teachers to say, hey, this was AI generated. Thank you, eSpark. And that would be, but Yeah, Mary, maybe you could talk a little bit about like how that worked, because it was
scary. What we had done was, as Ray mentioned, we had these Notion databases and we were unaware of evals. We didn't know about scorers or how to do that. So as our former teachers on the team were like, how did we used to score student work and student output? We created rubrics. And so we had these like extensive rubrics for what the output should be. And it was basically, I'll have this prompt in there, evaluate the output, copy paste all of that into our Notion database. Now go through the rubric, and any part of the rubric that it didn't pass, now go and change that portion of the prompt to try to address that part of the rubric. And we did that over, and we had like nice pass fail tags that we used along the way. And then after 20 passes, we were like, it's good to go. Let's move on to the next grade level or the next genre that we want to try to create a story for, or whatever it may be that we were creating prompts for at the time.
Okay, again, so many things I love that I just heard. So first of all, as an instructor, when I built my interview coach, I had this magical aha moment of the same way I teach students is how I'm going to teach the LLM. So this idea of we have rubrics, we're instructors, we do instructional design, we already know how to do this. What you just described, Mary, is actually more sophisticated than what a lot of teams are doing with evals even today. So like, I know that like your eval practice has evolved and we'll get into that. But this, I want to highlight, like what you just described is actually a pretty sophisticated eval process. You started with, here's a bunch of potential inputs. We're going to give it to the LLM. We're going to grade its outputs based on a structured rubric. You talked about true, false, and binary rubric metrics. For anybody who's been geeking out on evals, these are a lot of the things that are coming up as best practices. So I love that, like, the fact that you have an instructional design background and that you're an education company, some of these ideas like came natural to you. And this is something I think a lot about, because I think we have a hidden pool of subject matter experts that we could be tapping into, and that's all of our teachers. And I'm really excited to think about all the people that develop rubrics for a living in the education standpoint. How do we get them helping us build better AI products? That's a distraction, but I wanted to just throw that out there as an area that like I could geek out on forever.
For sure.
Okay. So I'm going to argue you were doing evals even at that stage, because that sounds like a pretty darn good eval process for where you were in your AI journey. But okay, so you've got a new customer problem. This one's focused on teachers. You've had some experience with kind of prompt engineering, a little bit of evaluating through kind of data sets and a rubric. Tell me about the teaching assistant. This sounds like it's a little bit more of a complex product.
Yeah, it definitely was. It was definitely like as we built sequentially, the first one was this generative story assessment engine we called Choice Text. That was these single, not just a single prompt, but several sort of sequential prompts in a workflow. We would then move on to playing around with OpenAI's Assistance API. We built a writing tutor that was interesting and rode the sort of assistance roller coaster for a while. It was okay. We didn't love it. We then did something with automated like speech recognition, speech synthesis to help with phonics, which is another sort of zag, and that was interesting. But then when we came to this teacher assistant one, the thing that we had to do that we didn't know how the heck we were going to do was to deal with a RAG implementation. Because everything up until that point, none of that required anything that looked like a RAG. Everything could just be embedded in the prompt and no problem. In this case, we had all this plethora of core curricula information, right? And then we also had all of the tons and tons of eSpark content. So we had this tens of thousands of eSpark activities that we've curated or created on our own over the last 15 years, and how to take those two data sets and structure them and use a RAG approach. We did not know what to do. So we did what everybody does and pulled up some podcasts and figured out like what are some of the best practices. Heard of Pinecone, heard of these vector DBs, didn't really know what to do. And then just very slowly, I think, try to pick baby step our way towards like a, we call them V1s, but like a very basic, ugly V1, just to see, can we get some amount of core curricula via RAG, some amount of eSpark content via RAG, and get a prompt to do the thing that we wanted to do. And yeah, so that was like the very early stage. This was like in, I think, November, December. So Tom had the Discovery Insight in April. We had to sit on it for a while because we were busy completing and finishing some of our things. And then when we finally started delivery on that, finally started actually trying to ship our very early V1. It was like towards the end of the calendar year 24.
Okay, I lots to dig in here, into here. So first, give me a sense of, from the teacher's point of view, what was your vision for this feature? What would they see? How would they interact with it?
It's funny because we had so many wrong assumptions specifically for our teacher population, even though we know them really well. We didn't know them in the new AI world. It was so interesting. So our whole sketching, early prototyping, visualizing, and we did a lot of it because the very first sort of prototype was like really fancy, interactive. I made it mobile, even though we're not working on mobile, but I wanted to know this is like an in-your-pocket assistant, and it's going to be a conversational interface, and teachers are going to be chatting, and like they're going to get data. And we had 15 different ideas in it. The thing worked great from like, we got the board interested and excited about it. There were some like, should we work on this? Should we not work on it? And I think that thing broke the mold. Mm-hmm. But we were stuck in this like, also coming from assistant and the way we're working with ChatGPT was through conversational interface. So we went 100% with this is going to be a conversational thing. So we built our first proof of concept. Yeah. And literally all it was like in hindsight, oh my God, in hindsight, it was literally just a text box. It was connected to our assignment database. I don't know if it was that must have been a RAG at this point already.
It was a text box.
Yeah. And then we would invite teachers like, hey, we got this. So we actually put it in their dashboard, in their own dashboard. So it was like, oh, what is this? AI assistant? And then they would like, and it's okay. So what are you going to type in? And they were, I don't know. What am I supposed to type in? And it just was this like complete, and then we started filling in the blanks. I could do this, let's try it. Okay. And so we were stuck in this like open text field thing. And then let's see, this was before we even thought of connecting it to curriculum. This was more us trying to figure out like, how are they going to interact with it? So we knew already, okay, teachers are going to need some help making this a little bit easier. And then we made a second, I think we called this, what was this, like an admin demo, where we actually had already connected it with a core curriculum. Like teachers could select a core curriculum from a dropdown. And the teachers we talked to, it wouldn't be their core curriculum because we only had one or two, and our teachers that we ran into had a different one. So let's imagine this is your core curriculum. So they would choose it, but then there still would be an empty text field. And then we would just watch them. What are they typing? What are they doing? And you could sense teachers' frustration, like, and we knew this, but we had to see it and experience it. Like, teachers don't have time to chat. Like, they're planning. This happens on Sunday night. They have the Sunday scaries. And they have tomorrow, there's 30 kids. What are we going to do? So if it's not, like, they don't really have time to, hey, ChatGPT, can you help me bubble? That's from a sort of UX perspective, we started leaning more into like, how can we make this like much more accessible and make this fewer clicks and don't make them guess what they have to type in.
It was a good reminder of like, all of us here talk to ChatGPT dozens and dozens of times a day. So the mental leap of just type whatever you want. That was just a classic case of a core assumption that you as a person do is not what the user does. And the teachers had this trepidation. Like the empty text box that we thought was a great answer, the teachers just had this trepidation of like, how do I ask it the right way? It doesn't matter, but teachers are rule followers. And they just, it was a really great sort of the example of a few interviews. Like it took us 4 or 5 teacher interviews to realize like open text is not the way for this to be super easy.
Help me understand, like you're describing this use case. I love the term, the Sunday scaries. Like I have a teacher is starting to look ahead to the week and they're going to eSpark. I imagine they have like time blocks in their day where they're like, this is eSpark time. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to pick the activities their kids would do during that time. Is that the idea? Exactly. Okay. And how did they do that before this assistant?
So we have an assignment search feature, which is basically where they type in a standard, type in a code, whatever language they use, they can type in like, we're working on coins. And then this is just a deterministic system that basically is like, okay, here are 3 assignments. But It's not aligned to anything. Teachers have to do the work. So this is the standard I'm working on. This is the grade level. So there's still a lot of work they have to do there.
Okay. So they were searching and filtering on their own. I can see where this kind of became supplementary because they probably weren't thinking about what's part of my core curriculum. They probably weren't like, it was just, I've got some time to fill. My kids like it. It follows their guidance, which is amazing. And you're trying to align this. So I imagine when you launched that chatbot, you were imagining teachers would type in something like, help me choose activities for my week, or I'm working on this lesson. What activities do you have related to that?
Yep.
But it was just hard for them. It was the blank page problem.
Totally. Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So I will get to the technical bits about RAG and how you learned all that, but I'm really curious about how the interface evolved. Once you realized chat wasn't going to work, where did you go next?
So there's, I think, two big features that I think helped a lot. There's actually three. One, we want to get into sort of the capabilities part but Ray can talk about that a little bit later. But for the final product, so we basically have a simple drop down right now, and it's like you choose your lesson that you're on, and immediately like the LLM will provide, okay, these are some lessons that we recommend. The thing is, our ambitions are a little bigger than just that. We want to be able to provide, like, because we have this like super smart LLM that can have taken lots of context and do lots of things, but we're still stuck with this problem of teachers don't know what's possible, don't know what to ask. So what we landed on eventually is, here are your assignments. And then we have the LLM create three follow-up questions that a teacher might have. And we did a lot of work on figuring out, like, what is the right sort of prompt for this follow-up prompt? What are the questions that a teacher might have based on the lesson content or based on our recommendations? And it's doing a surprisingly good job. So basically now what a teacher has, they basically select their lesson. They always know what lesson they're on, like whatever it's called. They know it and they go right there. They get the lesson. And then there's like question underneath, like, how can I extend these activities for my students that are struggling? Or how can I make this more? And there's a couple of suggestions.
Yeah.
And then there's a follow-up prompt that takes them to the next page. And sometimes like it generates a custom lesson. Sometimes it comes up with a bunch of strategies of how they can do it. But this is way more PD-like stuff, like professional development type stuff,
yeah,
and not the assignments. But we give them this path, and they can do that multiple times because every output will have three suggestions for what you can ask next. Mm-hmm. And part of it for us is to learn which are the ones that are getting most traction. We haven't done the work yet to really start analyzing this. This is what we're doing, this because this is the first season that it came out.
Yeah.
But we're looking at which are the ones that teachers are following up on to give us ideas of like other features that we can bring to the foreground. So right now it's literally just an assignment recommendation engine for your lesson, but we built a sort of mechanism around it for us to learn, for teachers to get additional value out of it, and for us to learn like what teachers are most interested in.
I want to make sure, first of all, I love this. I've heard from so many teams that are like, we started with the chatbot, it was clearly the wrong interface. I started with the chatbot, it was clearly the wrong interface for my use case. So let's say I'm a third grade teacher, I'm teaching long division this week. That's my lesson I'm on. I go into the tool, I select the long division lesson. That's the lesson from my school's core curriculum.
Right.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, so like your tool knows we're on this core curriculum. This week is long division. I'm gonna select that. By selecting that, I see a whole bunch of activities for long division in general. That's like, instead of searching and filtering, I'm just saying I'm on long division, give me some activities. And then you're going one step further. You're trying to anticipate, like, what are some challenges the teacher might run into when using these lessons? So things like, what do I do with my people that are like falling behind on long division? What do I do for people that are like racing far ahead? Is that right?
Yeah, exactly.
That's exactly.
Okay.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. It gives the recommended assignments. And then like, for example, we're giving all digital, right? All of eSpark's content is digital. So we're saying do all these digital things. And here's all these great digital activities for long division. And then down below, it might be like, what are some hands-on activities that I can do with my students? And Tom talked earlier about how they work in small groups and centers. So perhaps what we've done now is helped this teacher. They have their eSpark center that they can do those assignments on. And then they also now have this one more center that we've given them ideas for to do another long division with hands-on with some manipulatives or something like that.
I love this. I wish I had this as a third grader.
Okay. Reminds me of Tristan. I don't know how much you've played with the latest ChatGPT 5, but one of the things I noticed that's different, that 5 does really well that the other ones didn't do, is that after you ask something in 5, most of the time it asks you, would you like me to do X?
Yeah.
It has this follow-on, like,
yeah.
In my experience, like, it's really good. Yet, that's actually, so half the time I'm just saying, yes, do that. That's like a bit of, we built this before, before 5, right? But
yeah,
what we're trying to do is have those suggestions be like, oh, wow, like, you know exactly what I need. And there's things that we did at the prompt to make them as smart as we could with the context that we have about the teacher and the classroom, et cetera.
Yeah, this is great. And those prompts are both like huge time savers when they're right, but they scare me a little bit because it's a little bit like, we're trying to keep you engaged here forever. And I can imagine with teachers, they're trying to get in and out as fast as possible. But when they work, they save a ton of time.
Yeah.
Have you had to think about how to balance those two things?
We haven't run into the case where they're on the new teacher assistant too much yet.
Okay.
They're using the engagement we're really excited about. So one more piece of context, like our business is super seasonal. Now that it's September, early September now, finally schools are all back in session. So we did as much testing as we could before school was out in the spring with like alpha, beta, but now we're finally seeing like real traffic. TBD on, but that we file it under a very good problem to have if they're spending too much time on.
Yeah, highlight this just because I feel like this is probably less the case in education, but I feel like in technology, we're obsessed with engagement. And I feel like sometimes to the point where it's problematic, and that ChatGPT-5 example is one where like it's magical until it's not.
Yeah.
Right? If I'm spending way too long talking to ChatGPT because it makes it really easy, we're crossing over into not good.
Agree.
Okay, this is awesome. I can see how this has evolved. Let's go back a little bit and dig into some of your technical decisions. So it sounds like your V1, it's a chat window. You did have some early RAG. So just let me give context for RAG. RAG is retrieval augmented generation. So when an end user enters a prompt, so in your chat window, they're typing something in. Based on what they typed in, you're going to some database and saying, give me anything that's relevant to what they typed in. And you're sending that as added information to the LLM. So the LLM doesn't just get, here's what the teacher typed in. They get, here's what the teacher typed in, plus some extra info to help you answer it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It sounds like in that first instance, you were relying just on your RAG was just, if I heard you right, eSpark activities.
So we know we needed to have the sort of matching mechanism because we know we had the context from what the teacher needs, either through just their own open text, which we discussed was not easy for them to access, but really through like their core curriculum, lesson plan, scope, and sequence. And then we had all this eSpark content, and it's really this sort of matching exercise.
Yeah.
So one of the things was like, do we really, and this came about talking with the engineers, do we really need RAG? Is this just Ray heard RAG on a podcast and now he wants to build RAG? So we had to be careful that that wasn't the case. So we had to validate, can we just jam all this context like into the prompt? So we tried that for a little while and we realized like the core curriculum data is too dense and too, it was a mess. So we needed to figure out a way to chunk it and it felt ripe for sort of a RAG approach. And then on the same token, our content is much too vast. And also, if you just jam it into the prompt, you're paying for all the tokens. And scale this one and be mindful, make sure the teacher assistant doesn't cost us a ton of money to run every day. So token economization was important to us too. But what we didn't realize before we got into it was like all of the different sort of like RAG things, like the chunking and how to work with the all sort of creating the embeddings and the chunking. So we just had to ramp up on that as best we could as we learned. And I think one of the key learnings was like when you were talking about RAG, but really it's like tool calling, right? Where you're handing over the keys to the prompt to decide, does it call the tool or not? And that was a new muscle for us. So everything before we had it, these single shot prompts that didn't really have very much in the way of any tool calling. So it was tool calling plus connecting it to Pinecone and then all the sort of Pinecone RAG work there. And we just, as a team, fumbled through it, honestly. It was a combination of making sure we weren't doing anything that was too out of the mainstream, frankly, because we wanted to, we knew that the problem wasn't super niche. It was like a pretty commonly understood problem. And then it was just a matter of the three of us working together, talking with our engineering team, reading the docs, listening to a bunch of podcasts, and just trying to understand like what does good look like here, and then picking off the problems bit by bit and trying to scope it to, if all we want to do is like this first milestone, what would we need? And try to sort of classic, just keep the scope as minimal as possible so that we could get to something like connect the dots there. And yeah, with a bunch of trial and error and talking to the LLM about how to do it, we eventually got there.
Yeah, your very first version of this, did it have two RAG steps, one to pull eSpark lessons and then one to pull core curriculum?
No, it was just the one. It was just our assignment. I think there was a period where we hadn't quite landed on whether the core curriculum link was actually the right thing, right? We had, because we at one point started talking about capabilities, because we had these ideas like the initial prototype had 15 different ideas in there, and we had a hard time figuring out which was most valuable. So it took us a while to land on, okay, this is, and I think this first proof of concept, like we were still in a sort of vague stage. Let's give him access to our assignments and see how they interact with it and see if any patterns show up there. Okay. So that was just a one rag.
And for that first version, was your LLM truly agentic? Like it took the user prompt and decided how to call data from your assignments?
It was still one call to the prompt, but the prompt, like when you set the prompt to tool calling is auto, you can have it be required or none or automatic. We had it on auto and we had to make sure that we had it hooked up. So it was open text. So it was like, I want to search for long division. We would assume they would type in long division. And then understanding like how long division as an input goes into the prompt, and then the prompt then constructs sort of the RAG query, so to speak, and how to chunk it, how to get it back. That was all things that we just didn't know, frankly, what we were doing. And one of the key learnings there was like, we needed a lot more metadata, rich data on our content in order to make the RAG more in order to make the prompt and the RAG more capable. So we just gave it essentially like a replica of, we took a data, like a simple database table, just threw it up into Pinecone, ran some embeddings on it, and crossed our fingers and hoped for the best. And it turns out like it didn't work very well. There was a whole learning process of how do we go about creating embeddings that are meaningful within our data? And that was a whole sort of wild goose chase and an understanding essentially like how do you create valuable embedding content for our own content? And we ended up using LLMs to help us with that significantly.
Okay, so let's say V1 of your chat, I go in and I get over the hurdle of I don't know what to type in, and I type in, I'm teaching long division this week. Tell me what's happening in the background.
Yeah, so in the very early days, it would have been like, we would have had some amount of activities that had the words long division in them, right? Or related. And the way that we ran the embeddings, it was probably semantically related to long division. And then we would just essentially return, like the RAG tool would return 10 results, 5 results, whatever we decided we wanted to do. And then we had the prompt sort of stumble through picking the best 10, because we didn't want to give teachers 10 or 15 or 20 results. We wanted to give teachers our best 2 or 3 results, yeah. Right? So what we learned was like, it was very difficult for the prompt to determine what the best thing to recommend was, because the data associated with those activities was pretty, was just not rich enough, basically. So we would have, and it's because we never had to solve a problem like this before. So we had the title of the activity, like a short human written description of maybe like 80 characters, the URL, which that's not very useful, the grade level of it, maybe it's like the standards that it was associated with, but we did it. I think one of the learnings was that we were depending too much on the prompt, sort of trying to figure out those inferencing on the fly. And what we wanted to do is offload that from the prompt and do that asynchronously, and then depend much more on embeddings and semantic search, just bring that richness into the matching. So to answer your question, the very first version, we would have gotten a list of long division related assignments, but with not very good quality, because it didn't take into account the teacher's grade, or if it's more specific sort of query, none of the nuance would have been captured.
Yeah, okay. And that was one of those things that we also learned pretty quickly when we put it in front of teachers, and when we finally had coached them on what they could type in. And yeah. Ray just said the word inferencing, but that was one of the ones that I remember Tom and I being in an interview together, and the teacher typed in inference, And I think, or she might have typed inference or inferencing, and she clicked submit and it came back with no results. And I'm sitting here being like, I know my team has created like hundreds of inferencing assignments and activities. Why aren't they appearing? So we knew pretty quickly then that, yeah, like I was saying, we needed more data in there.
Okay, so you literally were dealing with user queries of one word is one challenge here. And then it sounds like one thing I'm trying to understand is for this first version, was it a workflow, like a RAG step was in your workflow? Like you just took the user prompt and sent it to your embeddings database, augmented the query, and then sent it to OpenAI or the LLM? Or were you giving the LLM access to a tool and the LLM was deciding to pull the data?
Yeah, it was the latter.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and that was your V1.
Yeah, that was our V1. And I think one of the things that scaffolded it for us that made it extra easy was we started using this tool called Braintrust.dev. Braintrust, I don't know. When we first started talking about, people didn't know about, but I think it's grown in popularity. Yeah. And what Braintrust does is gives you a UI to not only write the prompts and version the prompts, but also a nice UI to tie tool calling prompts. So while we didn't actually know how the prompt interacted with the tool call, we learned you have to explain to the prompt what tools it has access to, the inputs, outputs of the tools, things like this. But Braintrust made it a little bit easier to have us hook that up for our V1 because it disambiguated like how do you actually connect them, I think.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like you chewed off some pretty big pieces with this V1 of getting familiar with RAG, and your RAG was actually an embeddings database, which means you had to even know what embeddings database.
But it was not good in the sense that it was just whatever like the default settings were on all these tools. We just what we wanted to do was tie it together so that if a teacher types in a query, we get something. And it turned out that the something was disappointing or not that good or zero results. And then we tried to work our way back.
So it sounds like the primary problem you ran into with this V0, you uncovered sort of an interface problem, but you also uncovered, hey, our embeddings database is returning nothing when it should.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about how did you get better at embeddings? What did that look like?
So I think I want to just jump to the answer. I don't know if there's like so we didn't exactly know what to do at the outset other than try to understand. So when the prompt goes out, and we basically had to learn a lot about how these vector databases work and how these sort of embeddings work. And once we ramped up and understood a little bit more about the behind the scenes there, understanding why the results were bad, what we realized was just a lack of information in our content database for the embeddings to be meaningful at all. And like we're talking about long division, but like another example to help shine light on the difficulty is when teachers are teaching early reading, they teach all the different phonics. So they'll type in long A, long A. And we have a bunch of activities all about long A, short A, long A, short vowels. But like the embeddings that represent like the letters long A, it's like just not, it just struggles, right? Because, and you can see it can go the wrong way. So what we ended up doing was we spent a bunch of time completely offline, like outside of the product flow with an LLM with ChatGPT or something. And we just worked on how can we enhance the small amount of data that we have to imbue it with a lot more context and a lot more data. And that's where Mary and team did a ton of work to try to communicate within the prompt. So we basically have a whole sort of asynchronous prompt flow that takes our meager amount of keyword content, right? Because we can't have an LLM like go in and play our activities yet. And learn about the activities, right? It's really just going on the metadata of the activity in our database. What we ended up doing was giving it essentially like a schema to represent what each of our activities is. And it's essentially write out like what the learning objective of this activity is, what the standard is. And Mary, help me out here. Like what other sort of things that we...
I think we did some keywords in there, learning objectives.
We had to add, when we started adding subtopic, we had topic and subtopic. I think that would made a huge difference. Yeah. Like the topic could be phonics, but then the subtopic would be like long E. And I think that was a bit of an aha moment. Yeah. We iterated a lot on what that should look like. We had like domain in there just because there's certain topics that fall under different domains that have similar names, but they're in a different like reading or math domain. Would be a concept that falls under geometry or falls under algebraic thinking. It might have different names. So domain was important.
Yeah.
About this. So we're uncovering a lot of the challenges with embeddings, which I want to dig into. But first, I want to explore how this worked before. Like if I was a teacher and before teaching assistant, if I came into the website and typed in long A, would I have gotten activities?
If you hit the right keywords, you get it. Yeah, it was a keyword search. It was not.
Yeah, but what I'm hearing in this example is that this keyword was missing in your metadata. Or is it that it wasn't missing in the metadata? It's that sort of the semantic search part of embeddings.
Yes.
Brought up a whole bunch of irrelevant stuff.
That's okay. Because we have a lot of them titled long A activities, but it was not. It wasn't picking it.
Okay. All right. I want to dig into this because a lot of people equate RAG with embeddings databases, but those are not equivalent. All RAG is, we need to add data to the user's prompt before sending it to the LLM.
Yeah.
And a lot of people use keyword search as their RAG step. Mm-hmm. And it almost seems like keyword search out of the box might have been better than your embeddings out of the box.
It definitely could have been. It was a great example of we were just following, we're mimicking other people.
Yeah, totally. That's actually why I want to highlight this, because like with all this new technology, it's easy to be like, what's the shiny thing?
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily mean RAG was shiny or embeddings were shiny. Like you described a problem where both RAG and embeddings are solid solutions, but it also uncovered if we're going to get good at embeddings, we actually need way better structured data.
Yes.
Let me just, for people that may not be familiar with these terms, when we go from keyword search to embeddings, really what we're getting, we're going from like straight up, is this keyword in the document? And we can weight things like if it's in the title, rank it higher. If it's in this metadata, rank it higher. With embeddings, the easiest way to think about it is semantic search. Pull back any chunks in our embeddings database. An embedding is a chunk of content. Pull back any chunks that are semantically related to this term or to these terms or to this content. And I think what your story is uncovering is that like we're all fairly familiar with keyword search. It's been around for 30 plus years. And now there's this new skill of like, how do embeddings work? How do we create the right size chunks? How do we chunk things the right way? What goes in those chunks?
Yeah.
So that when there's this matching between user input and get all the relevant chunks, that search works.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
It ended up being that for the, we've been talking a lot about sort of our content and semantic search there. For the other side of the equation, which is the getting the core curricula information, it turns out we didn't need semantic search there at all. That was just much more basic RAG to your point of just grab this chunk of text and bring it into the prompt. So that was actually really nice because that was, so we thought we needed the same approach for both sides, but it turns out different approaches for each side, depending on the need of the prompt.
And
the need of the
content. And that's because for the core curriculum, you're not searching everything. You're just asking the teacher, what lesson are you on?
Exactly.
And you're pulling just that lesson.
Exactly. Yeah. We have been nice. One really nice thing about the use case is that teachers really only work on one lesson at a time. And we learned that one lesson can easily fit in the input, in the token window for a prompt without breaking.
Okay, love it. Okay, so we've got a basic architecture of, we've got an agent, it's got some tools. Mm-hmm. One tool is your embeddings database for your activities.
Yep.
Another tool is something that allows it to retrieve the lesson the instructor is currently working on.
Exactly.
And then between those two things, it can say, here's the activities that are relevant.
Yeah, exactly.
Tell me a little bit about how it's generating the follow-on questions.
I have to look closely at the prompt. I haven't looked at this in a while, but there's some instruction around. I have to look at the prompt exactly, but it's basically act as a blank grade teacher. Take this into account. What are some questions that a teacher might have? It's actually pretty basic. There's not a whole bunch of stuff in there. There might be a little additional context, but it's pretty basic. This is a very early experiment. Like we're basically seeing how much traction is this going to get. And what's going to get the traction. So we didn't spend a whole bunch of time on this. But once we get on iterating on this, we'll probably look more closely at that.
I feel like, Yeah.
Here's what I like is it sounds like you just stubbed out where this might go next and did just enough to start to collect data about where people might want to go next.
It's more a data collection thing than particularly providing immediate value. It's more for us, okay, which ones get traction, which ones get...
I think exactly what we did, if I'm remembering, Tom, in the prompt, so it's still in the prompt of the assignment recommendations. And then we say, after you've recommended these assignments, we went through and we like provided a list within our prompt of the things like my learning design team came up with things are like, what are like five things that teachers are generally looking for in addition? And it's the things we talked about. We were like, you can offer three suggestions from like this list of things that we want. And it's like providing scaffolds or providing a mini lesson or whatever it may be that we think are relevant to teachers. And then, like we said, collect the data to see, is it relevant to teachers?
Yeah. Excellent. Yeah. Okay. I do want to make sure we have time to get into evals because I know your team has gone deep on this. Let's use this teaching assistant to talk a little bit about, it sounds like you did some testing in the spring before school was out. You're now into fall. Tell me a little bit about your eval strategy for the teaching assistant.
Yeah, so it's been interesting. I think we've talked a lot about who all is involved in evals and who does the evals. And it's definitely been like a very like product, I think, more driven by the product team doing the evals along with the learning designers. Because as we talked about, having that domain expertise and knowing, are these good recommendations? Are they not? How do we look at it? And I think after we talked about the pain of doing our manual evals for our choice texts, when we learned that we could start doing these evals right within BrainTrust, I mean, it unlocked things for us and how quickly we were able to move. Because as we said, we've got hundreds of core curriculum that are out there and we want to make sure that we're creating these evals. So that's where we're at right now, is creating evals to make sure that we're matching assignments correctly with our core curriculum. And I think right now what we're finding is like the biggest like time suck, or where like we're putting the most energy, is into those data sets, because we still haven't found a way to like really quickly create these data sets, because we're trying to match hundreds of assignments to something within a core curriculum. But once we get those data sets in place, we have them, we can move quickly. And now we're doing matching. And so we've been doing some Python scoring with our evals to see what's the precision, how is that going, along with what are some of the other scoring.
Recall,
we did the recall scoring. Yep. We have a JSON score to make sure you know that the output is correct. And then finally, the biggest part for us has been the human scoring. Like, we still are very much keeping a human in the loop with that. And so I think the big learning we had was that our Python scores, we were like, oh, these should be hitting 80%, 90% is what we want to be seeing with these code-based scores. And we realized once we started doing human scoring, that was a completely unrealistic view of, you have humans creating the data sets, the humans are missing things that could actually be included in the data set. And so then we started doing these like teacher impression score. So if a teacher is looking at this at a glance, are they gonna like it? And then also another one that we're doing in the human scoring is like the breadth of recommendations, because these core curriculum have so many learning objectives. Is it only giving them one thing within their entire curriculum, or is it giving them all of the learning objectives that they have for that lesson or for that week? And so I think what we've learned is this human scoring has been really important, and it's helping us figure out what that now baseline is for our code-based scores that is an acceptable threshold. That obviously it's no longer 80, it's more like maybe a 60 is okay with these Python scores.
And just, Teresa, so just some of these core curriculum lessons, like there's certain core curriculum that have 24 different learning objectives. Each learning objective could have 3 or 4 assignments that are a good match for this. So you could have, for just a single lesson, you could have 50 assignments that could theoretically be a good match. And to do this for a representative part of a core curriculum, that's just a ton of work. So it's incredibly hard to get like 100% data set. It has to be like an approximation.
I see what you're saying. Okay, this is perfect, because my question was going to be, what does a data set look like? It sounds like you're creating a data set of, here's a core curriculum lesson. here's all the related activities that could be recommended. And then you're using that to score, is the LLM returning lessons from that set?
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then tell me, okay, so that's the kind of golden data set part. If they, for one dimension of, are they returning relevant activities? Mm-hmm. It sounds like you've also started to identify some other dimensions of the diversity of those activities. How are you, let's dig into that a little bit. How are you evaluating the diversity of the activities?
That is within our, I think, our recall, right? Mm-hmm. Our recall score.
Right.
I always flip our precision and recall.
The language
scores.
Is
our
hard,
recall.
Right?
Yeah.
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 So I think the precision is like, of the recommended assignments, what's the percentage of assignments that are part of the expected list and the expected column? And the recall, I always trip this up. I find it so hard to distinguish. The recall is like, if the expected data set has 20 things that are expected, how many are covered by the recommendations of, by our recommendations? But there's a natural limit to it, because if we're not going to recommend 40 lessons, because that's way too overwhelming. So there's a maximum of 5. If our data set has, if our expected column has like 30, it's limited what you can score there. So that was a bit of a challenge too.
Okay. And I'm assuming this is what some of your code-based evals are starting to look at. Some of the scoring.
Yeah. Those two are those. Yeah.
Okay. And then for your code-based evals, are they all kind of code assertions, or do you have some LLM as judges in there?
Currently for our teacher assistant, they're all code-based. But one of the things that we learned was, after going through Brain Trust, is we then circled back to what I talked about earlier of our choice texts and wanted to start running evals on those prompts. And in that case, we started creating some LLM-based scorers for that to help us understand like text complexity and understanding language and vocabulary and things like that incorporated into our stories.
Yeah, awesome. And for people that aren't familiar with Brain Trust, do you want to just give a overview? And I'll make sure in the show notes we add some links, not just to Brain Trust directly, but also I think Hamel, as part of the AI Evals Maven course, has published some like in-depth walkthroughs of the different eval tools. Mm. So for people that want to dig in, we can provide some links there as well.
I give advertisements for Brain Trust like daily. It is the reason it's so powerful and what makes it special is that it is at the same time, it's like an observability platform. If you just look at it, you're like, oh, this looks like a dev tool. This looks like an observability platform, like a Sentry. But the secret sauce of Brain Trust is that I think it takes what is normally the domain of engineering and it makes it accessible to non-engineers.
Yeah.
And it gives you a really wonderful sort of workflow loop for running evals that doesn't require you to bother an engineer or push code to do anything. So we have a bunch of non-engineers in Brain Trust daily creating data sets, creating scores, like the coding scores that Mary and Tom talked about. Like, Mary and Tom wrote the coding scores with an LLM in Python. Like, neither of them have taken a Python course. Maybe that'll change.
Yeah.
But like, it's all accessible there. And then so it has data set inputs, expected outputs, the scores themselves. And then the sort of the big aha for me when I was first looking at it was like the visualization of the traces and being able to debug. Like, one of the hardest things about the previous 2 years of building stuff before Brain Trust was the debugging and the understanding like what is going wrong here in this non-deterministic system was extremely painful. So we would have just a JSON blob in a database table, right? That we would throw in a JSON viewer and when it's 8 pages long and you're trying to figure out like what went wrong. In the Brain Trust flow, you have a whole trace of, here's what the prompt's doing, here's what the tool call's doing, here's what we got back from Pinecone, rinse and repeat. And then you can go in there, you can make notes, you can tag people, you can annotate, and then you can, with the click of a button, just run these evals over and over again. The workflow that team has set up now is like, whenever we go to publish a new curricula, because we're rolling them out every day now, Brain Trust is essentially like running the eval loop in Brain Trust is our go, no go for bringing stuff into production. And it's just made life so much less stressful, because otherwise, same thing goes if you want to switch a model, like a new model comes out or something, you want to switch. Like, it used to be this torturous process of, is it better?
Yeah.
You squint. And with Brain Trust, like, it gives you a quantitative lens onto, is it actually, is it that?
Yeah, so let me give some context for this. So we now have a handful of eval tools that all do pretty much the same thing. Yeah. So the first thing they do, which is one of the most important things, is they enable observability. So they're logging all of your traces. Whenever anybody interacts with your AI tool, it gets logged as a trace. So that helps with a human labeler looks at it and says, this is wrong. You can look through the trace and say, oh, this RAG call failed.
Yes.
You can figure out what exactly went wrong there.
Yep, exactly.
And then the second thing that they do, you can define, I know in BrainTrust, they call them scores. That's like, how are we evaluating this LLM response? Mm-hmm. That's really an eval. And then one of the really powerful things they do is once you've defined all your scores, if you make a prompt change, you can say, A/B test it against my current prompt.
Yeah.
Give me a score for my old prompt and my new prompt using all my scores, which is really great. Yeah. And I don't want this to sound like an advertisement for BrainTrust, so I will throw out a few other eval tools that are out there. There's also Arize, and in fact, we'll be interviewing a team from Arize about how they built their agent pretty quickly. There's LangFuse. I think LangFuse is the eval tool in the Lang ecosystem.
The call was another one we looked at for a minute.
Yeah, there's a lot of them.
Yeah,
and at this point, they all look really similar. But I know people love BrainTrust. I'm not trying to steer people away from that. Just do your homework if you're looking for an eval tool.
Yeah, we pay them. So it's not like we are, unfortunately, we are not sponsored by them.
Yeah. Okay, tell me, you've already alluded to this a little bit with your questions and collecting data. What's next for your teaching assistant?
So we have lots of big ambitions, but I think the number one bucket we want to have the teacher assistant do better is work with student data better and make their recommendations more contextually aware of how the students are doing, much like a teacher would do in our day-to-day. And there's a lot of really interesting data work to be done. How do we go about and feed, how do you feed the prompts the right amount of student data? Because it's easy to overwhelm it. So we're really excited about that. And then we're excited to finally have it out there and have thousands of teachers on it every day and giving us feedback. We do have a classic sort of thumbs up, thumbs down in the flow, and we're watching that like a hawk. One really funny thing is we do have an open text area of you can ask us anything. And one really funny thing, this is just like a learning that we didn't see coming, although our CX team told us it would come and they were correct, was teachers are using the open text. There's a separate page that you can just ask anything, even though as we said before, teachers aren't doing it. They're asking like customer support questions. Like, how do I print out this or how do I do that? So we were scrambling when we first started this come through in the logs, we were scrambling and giving it a little bit of knowledge to answer some basic questions, then having it divert over to our intercom customer support.
I was going to say, it sounds like you need Finn.
Yes.
But you're already using intercom, so that's great.
Yeah, we're using intercom, yeah. But that was funny, like unintended consequences of them using it for something that we didn't see.
Yeah, and I should publicly apologize to our CS team because I was like, that's not going to happen. Don't worry. And then it sure did.
All right. This has been amazing. It sounds like you have been on a great journey. I love how you fearlessly took on new things like RAG and embeddings databases and tool calls and even evals. Like BrainTrust this is not a dig on BrainTrust. These eval tools are not the easiest to learn. There's a lot in there. They're very powerful, but also a steep learning curve. Amazing. And I love that you're doing it with a really small team and just making it happen.
Yeah, one of the crazy, amazing things about these new LLM tools is like small teams are no longer a disadvantage, I don't think. Like you can move so quickly and build so much cool stuff and try things at such a low cost now that whereas before you would need a lot more infrastructure to try things out, I feel like.
Yeah, excellent. All right, thank you, all three of you. I really appreciate you taking the time. This has been a blast.
Thank you.
Thanks, Teresa. It's been fun. Thanks, Teresa.
If you enjoyed this conversation, please subscribe in your favorite podcast app and give us a rating as it helps others find the show. Thanks, I appreciate it.